Recording in progress.
So, it's very interesting, this retreat, because I keep feeling like either having loads and loads of words to say or none. I did actually do some thinking and reflecting, and I wrote all these sheets of paper with just random thoughts, thinking, well, maybe I can just put it together, but then I never managed to do that. But and I thought, oh, well, all that thing I was saying about wanting it to be still and not too much import, and I've got all these words. But I think for me, there's something about how we get to that place of stillness, that place of simplicity, that place of contentment, if we want to use the precept of stillness, simplicity and contentment, but certainly to try and find that still point in this turning world. We can't just immediately think, I want to be there and get there. You know, there's no destination to particularly arrive at. No easy route of getting there. We all have our own ways of getting there, and we'll come and go, maybe. Have moments, glimpses, experiences of stillness, spaciousness, equanimity, and then we'll be right back in all of the bustle and everything else happening around us. But if we've ever had even just one moment, we know it's possible. We know it's within us to reach that place, within our hearts, our minds. And I was thinking, well, the Dharma, there are so many different ways that the Dharma is presented, so many different teachings, and some will appeal to different people. There's different ways of practicing. Some people may be more into doing study and discussion. Some people may be more into meditation. Some people more into active in the world, the path of ethics. Probably for all of us, there's a combination of those. Some people more into ritual, devotion. And some of us, alongside with our practice, we have other ways of practicing. So maybe there's some creative side of us or response to art or nature. Maybe we're into gardening, growing. Maybe we're a little bit active in the world, a little politically active, or trying to change things socially for others. And those are all part of our practice. Those are all ways that we engage in the world, this turning world. And I'm not suggesting we don't want to do that. I think that is part of what we're trying to do. We want to have that, both that engagement, but also coming from a place maybe of not being identified, caught up in the world, where we're coming from a place of more stillness, place of more wisdom, place of more equanimity. So, yes, Amoghas Siddhi for me embodies those, but also green Tara, white Tara. So with green Tara, you've got her stepping down into the world, reaching out, very much engaging with the world, but she's still half of her in meditation posture. And she's in a way embodying that compassionate activity that we can engage with in the world. And you've got white Tara, who's much more still. She's in meditation posture. She's got all the extra eyes in her hands, her feet, the third eye. So she's got so much more awareness and insight, and she's sort of embodying the compassion. But the two are not separate. White Tara is full of compassion, and green Tara is full of wisdom. So from a Buddhist point of view, you can't separate compassion and wisdom. And when we talk about enlightenment and awakening, it's often described in terms of compassion and wisdom. They're also often described as compassion, wisdom and energy, which I think is interesting, and I think that side often gets neglected, and we'll want to explore a little bit of that on this retreat. But I think what for me is interesting is when you can hold the two together, and when they become one, in a way, which gets to the heart of some of the some of the practice, really, about trying to go beyond dualities, trying to go beyond the ways that we react to things, see ourselves as separate. I could go on and on, actually, around this. I probably will, but there's something about being able to hold dualities, hold contradictions, hold all the different aspects of our experience, inner and outer, and not necessarily see them as either or, you know, that they can both be together. So the world is turning. Buddha says the world is also burning, and we have this experience of the external world, which is the conditioned world, where things are impermanent, where there's lots of dukkha and suffering, unsatisfactoriness. And some of that is external and some of that is internal. But a lot of it is about the relationship that we have with our experience, with the world. That if we're resisting, if we're in conflict, if we're fighting, if we're trying to fix, then I think we get more and more into doing and being busy and trying to do stuff. And sometimes it's more about being able to be with what's there. So not necessarily, I'm not saying like being very pacifist and just accept everything. I know in my earlier life, I was very much maybe a bit more in victim mode, and I just thought I just had to go with whatever was happening. I had no choice, no agency. And what the Dharma has taught me very much is I do have agency, that my actions do have consequences, my choices do have consequences, and that's actions of body, speech and mind. So meditating can have as much, if not more, effect as some of the actions I do in the world. But there is something about aligning ourselves with reality, the way things are, and not resisting it, not trying to escape or fix samsara in a way, which I think I've spent a lot of my life doing, I still spend a lot of my life doing. It's so ingrained, you know. But those moments when I can let go of that, that's often when I do have that experience of stillness, of spaciousness, entering into something deeper, or maybe of things being connected, interconnected, understanding not with my intellectual mind, but on a much deeper level, how actually I'm just part of this whole, that the external world is not separate from my internal world, that I'm not necessarily separate from other living beings. And it's interesting that we can have those experiences in a very basic way just by being more with our experience, even more of just our experience of our bodies, you know, which are a manifestation of reality. They are impermanent, there's dukkha there, everything's in process. So all the marks of existence that the Buddha identified, the three lakshanas, we can see in a very, or experience, moment by moment, just by paying attention to our experience of our bodies, but also our motions and our lives. So I wasn't going to talk about any of that, so that just shows how how easy it is to get into talking about things. But I suppose for me, talking is sometimes a way, words are sometimes a way of trying to explore something, trying to get to something. Form and emptiness, structure, form and structure can be helpful if we're not attached to it, if we can see that and use it in that way. I mean, I was always a bit intrigued by the Buddha talking about the Dharma as a raft, and that when, you know, that you, it's something that you let go of, rather than something that, you know, this is the core teaching, and that you would always live your life by it and hold on to it. And at the moment, I am holding on to it because for me, the Dharma is my refuge. You know, the Dharma does give me that kind of way of being with, navigating, coping with all the difficulties, the uncertainty, the change, suffering of the world, and that I encounter. Because I think it's one of the reasons I like to fix things is because it's much easier, isn't it, when you're not certain. It's so hard to live with uncertainty, especially over a long period of time. I think those of us who are living through this pandemic and with all the changes that that's created to things that we probably used to think of, well, that's just how the world is, and we took for granted, and so many of those things no longer exist or have changed so much, and the government changes its mind minute to minute, or they were saying, well, hour to hour they would be reviewing the situation. So you never know, you can't really plan. And we could never have done that, really. We just had the illusion that we could, but now a lot of that illusion has been just sort of impossible to see because there's so much chaos and uncertainty and change happening around us. And so much in our face experience of impermanence, whereas sometimes it's possible to sort of just ignore it or hide it away if it's not in our particular set of circumstances, but it's global, you know. So many people have been ill or died from this pandemic, and there have always been people being ill and dying, but when it's happening on such a big scale and it's so much reported, which a lot of things are not reported, then obviously everybody now is faced with impermanence, you know, faced with change, faced with dukkha. And how do we not get overwhelmed by all of that, all the things in the world that condition us and all our reactions? Because for me, there's just as much about how I respond, how I react to my experience that's been key as the experience itself. So I think, as I was saying, before I experienced the Dharma, I didn't really have a context, a way of understanding or responding to my experience in a sort of helpful, creative way. And I did get into much more of the drama of it and seeing myself. Well, I think we all see ourselves as at the centre of our lives, our world, our universe. And there's a whole drama around how we live our lives and what happens to us or doesn't happen to us. But we can make more of a drama if we choose to. And certainly, I lived in a family and we all did that. We went from crisis to crisis and, you know, well, everybody was always in a crisis, you know. And if you weren't in a crisis, well, you couldn't even conceive of that. But also, I remember when I stopped having quite such extreme reactions and dramas in my life that I kind of thought, well, am I just becoming boring, you know, because I thought that was about being alive, having those really intense experiences. And it's interesting because although there are some things that are still difficult and challenging, I think the Dharma's given me tools to respond in a different way, with more equanimity, more patience, more kindness to myself as well, more compassion. And also, alongside that dharmic perspective, which means that I'm not fighting reality so much. You know, if I accept that things are impermanent, well, of course, things in my life are also going to be impermanent. If I expect that there is dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, well, of course, that will also be in my life. So just to be able to sort of have that perspective, okay, yeah, it's dukkha. Yes, I might try and change things so that they're not quite so difficult, but yes, it's dukkha and I'm never going to get rid of all dukkha. You know, this might pass, but something else will arise. And if I'm not fighting it, resisting it, or taking it personally, I think then I don't get into the fight, I don't get into the drama, I don't get into the resistance, and there is much more, I suppose much more resilience and equanimity in responding to whatever I'm experiencing externally and internally. So not just the emotions and the thoughts, but what's happening in my life. You know, I now know how to meditate, and that gives me some stability. That gives me the opportunity to deal with things differently. I also have different tools for how I am in the world, how I relate to other people through practicing ethics. And I have that, that dharmic perspective that I was saying that gives me much bigger idea and also an awareness of other levels, other realities that I was aware of, but it gives me a framework that I can put everything into, understand everything with, or see everything through. And through that, I personally have found that I have been able to access more stillness, more equanimity. So it's something about, for me, can I be with my experience rather than resist my experience? Can I see things as they are? It's quite, you know, there's so many dharmic teachings, and you can get totally overwhelmed. I certainly can get totally overwhelmed by all the teachings and all the stuff that I haven't read, haven't studied, and especially if it's in Sanskrit and Pali, and I think, oh, I don't know all those words, and what does that mean? And even the ones that are very common, I can have a whole reaction to. And even the ones that aren't in Pali. So like for me, enlightenment has been quite an intimidating word. Shunyata. I still, when everyone says shunyata, there's part of me that just wants to sort of run away and hide. But at the same time, I'm totally intrigued by it. What is this thing? And I guess we all have our own words that might work better. You know, but this exploration of form and emptiness, of going beyond these dualities, for me there's something there which I think is probably related to what people are talking about with shunyata. I've also been interested that shunyata can be equally translated as fullness and emptiness. And there's something about it not being rationally understandable, that there are all these mysteries, there's so much of our minds that aren't our thinking mind, and there's so much of reality that we can't just label or explain or, you know, study and explain however much we may want to. You know, and scientists are always, you know, it's always provisional, you know, the theories, the ideas they have, and then someone has a discovery and it changes everything, and then someone has another discovery, it changes everything. You know, it's not... nothing is fixed, even though we like to have things fixed for our own sense of security. So yeah, that you could be complete, spend your whole life trying to read even just a small part of the teachings. And especially in these days when we have the internet and we have access to all the videos on YouTube and, you know, books galore we can download, we can hear people giving talks. It can be hard to find your way through all of that, can't it? Which is where I think the idea of simplicity is really helpful in one's practice, to actually just find some simple practices, some simple teachings that work for us, or work for us at this point in time, and just be with those and not worry about the rest. You know, because actually my experience is the more I go into any dharmic teaching, it connects up with others. So again, there's a kind of a paradox between simplicity and complexity for me, that part of me, especially my cognitive thinking mind, really likes complexity and really likes sort of discovering new things and seeing how they all fit together and making parallels. And there's another part of me, which is probably more helpful in my practice, that just likes to let go of all of that and then find one or two things that I reflect on and coming over again. Maybe it's a verse, maybe it's a saying, maybe it's a particular practice. And just go deeper, you know, have deeper understandings rather than trying to get more and more superficial knowledge. Because with the Dharma, well, certainly my experience with the Dharma is that you can understand it intellectually, but it's not until you actually find your own relationship and understanding of it and make it part of your life, part of your practice, that it becomes meaningful and that you get more understanding. So it's almost like a constant uncovering more of the meaning of the Dharma through practice. You know, that I come to it with a limited understanding, even though I think I may understand it completely, and then I try and practice it, and then months, years down the line, I realize, oh, there's this, this is what it's really about, you know, because I've had that experience and it's opened my eyes and I understand it on a deeper level. So like we can know things, you know, we can see patterns of behavior, we can think, oh, that's not good, I ought to change this, we're never going to change it, unless we have some insight. Sometimes we have an emotional insight or a spiritual insight, and that's when we are motivated and that's when the change happens. And you can't force that. You can't force yourself to awaken or to have insight. And however disciplined you are in your practice, you can't really force yourself to have a particular experience, yeah? But you can create conditions where things are more likely to happen. And for each of us, that will be different, the conditions that are helpful for us. But I suppose what I'm suggesting is that I think simplicity is a really helpful condition. Stillness is a really helpful condition. Not necessary to have it the whole time, but have it integrated as part of our lives. And there's always an interesting paradox between something and its opposite. We do go into these dualities, and it's by exploring the dualities that often they can come together and we can transcend them in a way. So movement and stillness, very much connected. You know, the inner, the outer. And silence. Silence has more meaning when there's sound around it, I think, or words around it. As a musician, I think a lot of great music has that interplay between sound and silence, and significance that having a period of silence or a pause, and then that also highlights when you resume the sound. And I think it's the same with stillness and movement with our lives as well. We can be very, very busy doing lots of stuff, and that's fine, and maybe we need to do lots of stuff, certainly to live our lives in the world. It often involves doing lots of stuff. But if we don't balance that out with these periods of stopping, of being still, being quiet, then we're just going to succumb to Western laziness, as the Tibetans say, when we're just being so busy doing things that we don't give ourselves time in our lives to explore what's really important, what's most meaningful. There's a really there's a lovely little piece of writing that Sangharakshita wrote when he was very young, called Pauses and Empty Spaces, where he's making that connection about that relationship and the need for silence, the need for pauses, you know. He sort of makes the analogies of like a painting that's just completely crammed full with figures, or music where there's no silence at all. That it can be painful as an experience, but it also doesn't allow us that space. Because when we're too busy with stuff, when we're really fixed in patterns and habits, how is change going to happen? Without any awareness, without any reflection, without space around it for us to sort of realise what we're doing and maybe become aware of other possibilities. I don't think it's a mistake that in all the different formulations of the Dharma and practice, meditation is very key. And I think that's because when we meditate, there is that element of stopping, of being still, of turning towards our experience, opening our minds and our hearts to whatever's arising, getting to know ourselves. And if we keep on with this practice of meditation, we will get to know our conditioning, our views, our habits, all the things that we've developed throughout our lives. And then have that possibility of doing something different. Consciously creating conditions for change. And if you don't have those, people do it in different ways, I guess. You know, I think someone who goes fishing and spends the day fishing, it's probably their equivalent of meditation, you know. And quite often you talk to people and they're not that bothered about whether or not they catch anything, but it's just actually being there, quiet. And they're often by themselves in nature. It's a moment of sort of, I think, pausing being, you know. And I think we find our own ways of doing that, even if we're not meditators. But certainly meditation is a really good way of creating some stillness, some spaciousness in our lives and in our minds, particularly if we allow our minds the opportunity to explore and play rather than always directing it to a task or to achieving something. Yeah. So yes, as I said, I would invite you on this retreat in all your meditations to not even try and do anything in them or achieve anything or have any particular experience, but just be open and receptive. And out of that openness, that receptivity, that creates a potential space where stuff can emerge, can surprise you, where you can maybe find yourself listening to a deeper side of yourself, a deeper voice. But that voice often gets submerged when we are caught up with the busyness of our lives and the world. And it does, you know, you do need to create conditions. I mean, any of you who may be used to doing anything creative, you know, whether you're a writer or a painter or a composer or a dancer or a, I don't know, there's probably loads of other things that you could think of. Certainly for me, I need some space. When I'm getting very caught up in my life and work and all the things, I just don't have to, right, I can't get into that mind space, you know? Because the mind, I think, needs to relax, it needs to be open, it needs to be spacious. I can't go straight from planning something or discussion or talking about center finances into, you know, writing a poem or doing a painting or thinking creatively. And I can't just program some time into my life, say, okay, I'll have a day off and then that'll happen. Sometimes I need much longer, which I think is why going on solitaries and going on retreats can be really helpful, because it just gives us that break from our everyday stuff. And I think in terms of simplicity, and simplicity of practice, simplicity of intentions, for me, I keep coming back to, well, the path is all about cultivating kindness and awareness. You know, developing more compassion, developing more insight, awakening our hearts and our minds. And that's all we need to be doing. At any given point, is anything we're doing helping in that? And I find myself also being drawn to just the simple formulations of the Dharma, or just simple teachings. So for me, the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom is all I need. and I may be focusing on one aspect more than another, but having that as the context and working with all of them is really, really helpful. And it's, I don't have to worry about, do I understand this, this, this and that. I have got an understanding of what ethics and ethical practice is. I have got an idea of meditation and meditation practice and wisdom, particularly in terms of just trying to align myself more with how things are, with reality, from that dharmic perspective. So yeah, I like, sometimes the Dharma's talked of in terms of stopping and seeing, or stopping and realizing. And again, I love the simplicity of that. And what is it that we're stopping? What is it that we're seeing? That in itself, you know, could be a lifetime of practice. And it's not too complicated. I must confess, I don't know what all the 52 mental events are in the Abhidharma. When someone talks to me about one, I think, oh yeah, I can really understand it. I think, how amazing that this was there thousands of years ago, and you see all the psychoanalysis coming up with the similar ideas. And maybe one of them I'll find helpful at the time. And I think it's really great teaching, and I really like that that's there. But that's not necessarily something that I can sort of bring into my everyday life. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. But I can stop and I can see at any point, whether I'm meditating, whether I'm in a work situation, a social situation, there's always that opportunity of stopping and seeing. I mean, you might not literally stop, but you might stop the, yeah, in terms of what are we stopping, are we stopping the internal stuff or the external stuff? So you can be quite busy, but internally there's something that you've seen and you've stopped, or you've got a different kind of an insight to. I know I'm talking a lot, but just wanted to sort of, in a way, like lay out some of the territory, because I am hoping to do less talking as we go on. But there, for me, there's something about the stillness and the stopping, that it's all about working with those reactions to those key things like craving and aversion, which in a way are the same. When you look at them, they're just different approaches to it. And that can be inner and that can be outer as well. I mean, again, in the same poem that I was quoting yesterday, there's a line in it, something like, desire is only movement, or desire itself is movement. So our craving creates a movement towards, or aversion creates a movement away from. And when we can get beyond those Vedana responses, we can see those Vedana responses and maybe choose not to react. For me, that's another way of getting to that still point. I'm not push and pull between my responses to different aspects of my experience. And it's a path, isn't it? It's a process, it's a practice. So it doesn't happen quickly, it's over time. And I think lastly, I'd just like to say that what I find quite helpful is not always being too serious about it. We can approach these things in a playful way, rather than, I must have this great insight. So I did say yesterday that I'm going to bring in the Heart Sutra quite a lot, because I think for me that's comes to the heart of all of this, trying to go beyond all these dualities, try to get beyond just our thinking mind, trying to open to things that we can't really conceptually understand. And I love the way that within it, it's also saying that the Dharma doesn't exist, there's no path, there's no such thing as attainment. So all the things that we're trying to do, it's saying they're not there. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. That's been resonating, reverberating in my mind quite a lot again these last few days. And I think one of the ways that we can loosen our attachments is, yeah, just seeing through, just seeing that, you know, there is that element of impermanence, emptiness, or maybe unsatisfactoriness in it. Or that it's only limited, you know. So I was in a bit of a silly mood this morning when I was having breakfast with Penny and Anita. We were talking about things, and I suppose I was aware I was doing this talk, and things came up, like having forgotten socks, because we're staying here at the centre for this retreat, so like socks are only emptiness, and porridge is only emptiness. But actually, it's quite a good practice just substituting all the things that we are quite attached to with that, and then adding is only emptiness, you know. And we'll all have our different things about what might be emptiness that we can think will be giving us the, you know, our way of fixing samsara, or giving us happiness when we're going for those more superficial things that aren't, you know, I suppose we're getting to the territory of true and false refuges. And again, there's something about holding all of that lightly, I think. And there's nothing wrong with finding things helpful or that do give us, you know, a way of coping or dealing with life and its difficulties, as long as we don't get attached to them, as long as we don't think that they're the ultimate reality. So I think I'm going to stop there. Having said a lot more than intended, and I would just advise you to, if there's anything there that resonated, just stick with that and ignore the rest. But we're going to do a little, I'm going to invite you to join in with a little reflection exercise now. So you can do this just sitting in your head, or if you want to have a piece of paper to write on, then you might want to just get yourself a pen and paper or something. But basically, we're going to be reflecting on some of the things that we may be a little bit attached to, and then just try writing down, or in our head saying, chocolate is only emptiness, for instance, or sex is only emptiness, or... Which is not to say that one wouldn't eat chocolate ever again or have sex, but just to play with that, see what it feels like. So I'm going to ring the bell, and we'll just have some, we'll say about 15 minutes of silence just to reflect and find some things you could attach that phrase to and see what effect that has. And then you can carry on if you feel like it doing that later on during the day or the retreat as things emerge. Okay. So I realised that I didn't kind of give an outline of the session or the day. And we have decided on this retreat. And again, I think this creates a little bit more simplicity that we'll basically alternate the days we lead. So I'm leading all of today and Pani needs to be leading all of tomorrow. Which is quite nice because it means that one can sort of like go through different things during the day. So there'll be a little bit of time just now if anybody wanted to share anything that came up during that little exercise. And then we'll have a like 5 minute break and then we'll go into doing some meditation, reflection, and that'll be the end of this session. A second session, there'll be the groups for those who want to come to them, and then there'll be some meditation practice. And in the evening, there'll be a mix of some ritual and meditation practice. So that's the basic plan for today. Along the way, maybe exploring some of these things in different ways. There's different ways in, aren't there? Talking, thinking, reflecting is one way in, meditating in another. Ritual, devotion is another way in. So, anybody have anything that they noticed or experienced or any sort of insights, awareness they felt like sharing with the group now? And if so...
Recording in progress.
So just arriving back into this shared practice space. And also arriving into your meditation posture. And you've been moving, you've been doing things, and now we're going to have a short period of stillness and quiet. As a transition into that quiet, we're going to have the reading of the Heart Sutra. And just allow your mind to be maybe like a lake. All those depths below and our words, just pebbles rippling out into your psyche. Into your body, into your heart and mind. The Heart Sutra. The Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. Here then, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness, no other than form. Form is only emptiness. Emptiness, only form. Feeling, thought, and choice. Consciousness itself are the same as this. All things are by nature void. They are not born or destroyed, nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane. So, in emptiness, no form. No feeling, thought, or choice, nor is there consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No colour, sound, smell, taste, touch, or what the mind takes hold of, nor even act of sensing. No ignorance or end of it, nor all that comes of ignorance. No withering, no death, no end of them. Nor is there pain, or cause of pain, or cease in pain, or noble path to lead from pain. Not even wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. So know that the Bodhisattva, holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in perennial wisdom, is freed of delusive hindrance. rid of the fear bred by it. And reaches clearest nirvana. All Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time, using this Pranya wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. Here then, the great Dharani, the radiant, peerless mantra, whose words allay all pain, the Pranya Paramita, whose words allay all pain. Hear and believe its truth. Gate gate para gate para sangate bodhiswaha. So we're coming to the end of this morning's session. And just sort of noticing the transitions in the day, transitions from the sessions of the retreat to your everyday life, but also as you go about your life, there'll be transitions. So noticing that, maybe noticing movements from stillness to activity, busyness, to a little bit more quietness, sound, noisiness, discursiveness, talking, to periods of quiet. And this afternoon we'll be doing exactly that. So there'll be the groups at 4 for about half an hour, and people will, well, ideally you'll be in the same groups, but if everyone decides they don't want to be in the group that day, then we might mix you up to whoever's there can be in groups. And yeah, the invitation is just to listen to yourself, because sometimes you might really want to be with people and connect up and talk, and other times you might just want to be quiet. And so let us know before the groups that day if you're going to be there. Or you could be in your group and be quiet. But anyway, after the groups, so if you're not going to be in groups, I suggest if you get here about 4:25, so you can be ready to do some practice at 4:30. We'll have an hour of silent practice, and the plan at the moment is to have a sort of like mini session where we'll have short periods of sitting, standing, walking and sitting. So I hope to see you there. Evening, we'll be doing some more meditation and we'll be doing some ritual, maybe not a puja, maybe a puja, maybe something made up, but there'll certainly be some chanting and some sitting and some connecting more with devotional practice and that side of things. So thank you all very much for coming and practicing. If you want to unmute yourselves, say goodbye to each other, feel free. Does that mess up the recording? I don't know.